On June 4th, 1983, my high school was one of the many that took us to Disneyland for grad night. If you've ever been to Disneyland on grad night, you know how much fun and how crazy it can be. The park stays open extra late. The skippers who drive the Jungle Cruise boats let loose and tell dirty jokes, and there's plenty of opportunities for people to sneak booze and weed in. Getting a bunch of amped high schoolers in Disneyland is one thing, but with the nightlife and party atmosphere behind it, things can get pretty nuts. My two friends and I, Anaheim locals, were particularly excited. We all loved Disneyland, and while we didn't get to visit often, living practically in the park's backyard gave us more opportunities than most. In addition, we hadn't been since the new Fantasyland opened earlier that year, going from a sort of medieval fairground into a storybook village, so I was kind of looking forward to that. Unlike a lot of people who were there, we intended to keep things clean and have a grand old time of it. Hit as many rides as possible and just revel. But the big plan for the night was kind of ambitious and maybe a little reckless. To this day, I can't remember who suggested it first, only that we all thought it was a great idea. We'd already gone into the park and gone on a number of rides when it was brought up, while we were sitting on a bench in Frontierland eating churros. From where we sat, we could look across the rivers of America to Tom Sawyer Island and past that where the river curved to New Orleans Square. Poking above the trees was the cupola of the Haunted Mansion, with its clipper ship weather vane. The sun had just gone down, and the sky was awash with dull orange and purple clouds, most of which seemed to loom behind the cupola. I pointed out how perfect and spooky the whole thing looked, and that got us talking about it. The mansion was a collective favorite, and being dumb kids, we agreed to do a little exploring to effectively spend the night in the Haunted Mansion. We laughed about it as we got in line for it, moving past the brick columns and up the walk toward the mansion, but inside I was a bit nervous. You have to understand, security was a bit more lax back then, so it was plausible that we'd be able to pull this off if we were careful. Plus, grad night always had kids getting into trouble, and the likelihood of us getting banned for good was not as high as it could have been. But I still felt tense, that feeling you get when you're scared about going on a thrill ride for the first time. Excited, but hesitant. The three of us, Mike, Karen, and myself, had it all worked out. When you first enter the mansion, you're escorted into a room that seems to stretch and warp before your eyes, which is actually an elevator that takes guests below ground, where a hallway connects to the ride building beyond the park's berm. As everyone else crowded out of the room and into the hall of morphing portraits, we lagged behind, which the disembodied voice of the ghost host jokingly warned you not to do, and fell in at the very back of the line. By the time we piled into our doom buggy, there was no one else behind us, and the black, endless procession of clamshell-like cars were empty. We went through the ride as normal, cracking jokes and making banter at all the old familiar scenes, until we reached the exit crypt. We stepped out onto the moving platform and walked toward the escalator ramp that leads from the crypt back to the park outside. If you don't know, the escalator hugs the wall on the right, but on the left is a small crypt scene where a tiny, ghostly bride stands on a stone shelf and tells you to hurry back, hurry back. Mike took charge here, deliberately turning backwards as he went up to watch the cast member near the buggies below us. Mike's a big, broad-shouldered guy, a football player through and through, and his bulk hid me and Karen from view as we slowly ascended. At his signal, when the cast member monitoring the exit had his back turned, Karen and I climbed over the rail and dropped down into the cryptic scene, where we quickly scurried under the dusty space beneath the escalator. Mike was over a moment later, and we laughed and congratulated each other on a job well done. We must have spent a good hour or so down there, giggling into our hands whenever we heard footsteps and voices overhead of unsuspecting people exiting the ride. Karen even had some snacks she'd brought with her, and we sat there in the dark and ate and whispered to each other. It was like being in a weird clubhouse, and it felt good that we three shared this delinquency together, even as the narration of the ghost bride looped over and over again in the background. Hurry back, hurry back. Be sure to bring your death certificate. If you decided to join us, make final arrangements now. We've been dying to have you. Eventually, The novelty wore off, and we got quiet, and then listless. Sure, we'd managed this much, but then what? Karen pointed out that it had been eerily silent for a while. Other than the monotonous speech of the bride and the other spooky ambient sounds, there were no more people coming up the ramp. Mike said he thought maybe the park had closed, but that made no sense because it was open all night on grad night. Not wanting to get in trouble, but also wondering what was up, I volunteered to clamber back up and take a look. When I did, using some of the crypt scenery for hand and footholds, I saw that there was no one around, not even a cast member down at the unloading platform at the end. When I reported this, Mike and Karen climbed back up as well, and we went back down to the unloading station to look around. All the doom buggies coming along the corridor were empty, and there was not a person in sight. It was odd, to say the least, and I felt like something was definitely off to have this place be so empty. I was about to suggest turning around and heading back outside when Mike said he'd always wondered where the doom buggies went after they dropped you off. They rounded a dark corner in the crypt area and vanished from sight, and Mike was curious as to what was down there. Now, really, I should have said no, that there was no point, that we could get into some serious trouble if we snooped around back there. It's probably just the utility corridor anyway, since the buggies just looped back around to the loading room anyway. But I was young, and I was stupid, and when presented with a golden opportunity like that, it was hard to pass up. So we went ahead and jumped into a doom buggy going by, and it slowly rounded the corner into darkness. This was uncharted territory for us. And even if it turned out to be boring back there, at the very least, we'd get a chance to see it and maybe get another ride out of it. Hardly a day goes by where I regret not having said something. The main thing I remember was how Spartan it was. It wasn't quite pitch black, but it was even gloomier in there than the rest of the ride. There were small lights set into the walls on either side of the track, but they were low to the ground and far between. The walls were painted black, and the corridor seemed so narrow that I felt boxed in. It was quiet, too, other than the hum of the track moving the buggies. I felt tense, and Mike and Karen weren't helping that because they looked tense, too. I think it was dawning on all of us how much trouble we might get in. I think a minute or so had passed like this, us going down that dark, featureless backstage corridor, when the ride suddenly stopped and I nearly jumped out of my skin as a voice came from somewhere overhead. And it laughs when I realized I'd been startled by the normal breakdown spiel. "Playful spooks have interrupted our tour," the recording went. "Please remain seated in your doom buggy. We'll proceed in just a moment." The teasing was immediate, as we all pointed out to each other how we'd jumped. We waited for the ride to start again, and every 30 seconds or so, the spiel would play. "We've been unappointedly detained by prankish spirits. Kindly remain seated in your doom buggy. We'll continue our tour momentarily." This went on for a good long while, 10, maybe 15 minutes, and still the buggies hadn't moved. No one had come looking for us. We were getting antsy, and the silence between the announcements was becoming unsettling. Then Karen leaned out a bit and looked around, and she noticed the door first. Just ahead, past the buggy in front of us, work lights revealed a little alcove and a utility door on the right-hand side of the corridor. We were so sick of being in the buggy by that point that we were willing to try anything, so after a short discussion, we all squeezed out of the buggy, pressed against the wall to go past the next one. Mike had trouble here, and stood before the door. I pushed it open, finding it unlocked, and it led to a metal staircase leading down into the darkness, footlights like the ones in the corridor revealing where to go. I was thinking of excuses in my head as we went down the stairs to explain why we were likely stepping into Disney's underground utility corridors, the infamous utilidors, said to run like a spiderweb beneath Disneyland if someone found us. By this point, I was hoping someone did. At the bottom of the stairs, another closed door with a sign on it, reading "Cast Members Only." We pushed through that as well, and were legitimately surprised to see that it had opened to what looked like a themed hallway. Disney, even backstage, seemed to be paying attention to style, as this hall supported the purple demon wallpaper and wainscoting of the rooms above. It was even lit by candle sconces on the walls, the fake flickering bulbs coated with cobwebs and dust. Several detailed wooden doors lined the hall with out-of-place white placards mounted on them. Each was marked as a prop room with a corresponding number. As we made our way up the hall, we tried each door we came to and found them all locked. The first door, prop room 1, shook a bit, but it wouldn't budge. Same with 2 and 3. Mike chuckled and said he wondered if they'd find Walt Disney's frozen head down here, but I could hear a nervous waver in his laugh. Even I was feeling some sense of dread with each door we tried, something hard to place, but was nagging. At door 4, I put my ear to the edge of it and thought I heard what sounded like rushing water or faint TV static from the other side. And at 5, I noticed that the folk candles flanking it were flickering more sporadically than the rest, like they were faulty. Door 6, to left and near another plain utility door that marked the hall's end, was the only one that yielded to us, and I was the one who turned the cold handle and opened it for the first time. It's difficult for me to describe what I saw in there without shuddering, because even now my telling makes it sound fairly normal. That is, as normal as a room hidden under a theme park attraction can possibly be. It wasn't very big, almost like a large storage shed. Unlike the hall, this one was the bland utility black and lit by a single fluorescent light in the ceiling, albeit a dim one. The walls were lined with metal cabinets, and there was some sort of large archaic gadget shoved into one corner, not unlike the old computer banks from the 60s. But what caught my attention right away was the grinning figure near the wall, across from the door. A dummy, or animatronic of sorts, lifeless and unmoving, but standing on its base. The discovery was fascinating to all of us. Without thinking, we all edged into the room and immediately approached the figure. It was clearly meant to be one of the ghosts in the ride. The specter in a top hat with a skull-like face, cartoony bulging eyes, and leering smile. One of the teeth was even painted gold. He stood in a bow-legged stance, one gnarled hand holding a crane and the other a hatbox. None of us had ever seen this particular character on the ride before, though Karen said its face looked a lot like the tall, skinny hitchhiking ghost from the end of the ride. I was just turning away from the figure to look at the cabinets when there was a combustion roar from the hall outside, like the sound of a passing motorcycle followed by a loud, bassy boom that made the floor shake. The door to the room swung shut and the fluorescent light sputtered and went out, leaving us in total darkness. Mike gasped and Karen screamed, and I was just reaching out for them in the dark when I heard a peculiar whirring sound. Another light came on, this one a concentrated green light above the hatbox ghost, showing its skeleton smile for a moment before that light faded and another faded on, illuminating the hatbox. I could see through the material of the hatbox now, and saw the ghost's head grinning at me from inside. The pattern repeated itself rhythmically, making it seem like the ghost's head was disappearing from his shoulders and appearing in the hatbox. It wasn't a terribly convincing effect, but in the dark, and with strange things going on around me, it genuinely scared me. I turned and stumbled through the room, ready to get out of there, feeling around for the door. Now even the light on the ghost shut off, and I heard Karen and Mike's feet behind me, a crash, and the sound of something solid tapping the concrete floor. I tried pushing the door open, but it wouldn't budge, and somebody slammed into my back in the dark and caused me to hit it hard. I was dazed, but unhurt, and another scream from Karen fueled my adrenaline even more. I instead gave the door a tug, and it opened. I was out in the hall without a second thought, without even looking back. I started running, sprinting back the way I'd come, gasping for air. I was never a very athletic kid, but panic kept me going. I heard sounds behind me, footsteps, Mike and Karen yelling in terror as they followed, and what seemed like rapid knocking and banging on the doors around me, but I refused to look over my shoulder. up the stairs and back into the Doom Buggy corridor in what felt like a matter of seconds. The Doom Buggies were moving now, endlessly traveling through the shadows. I knew it was risky to jump into one in this narrow corridor, and for a moment I stopped, trying to figure out what to do. I finally looked back down the stairway I'd come from. I thought Mike and Karen had been right behind me, but they were gone. I called out their names, my voice echoing down the stairs, but there was no reply. Not until I heard something tapping the metal stairs, coming up toward the door, and saw an unfamiliar, vague shadow on the wall that I flung the door closed and dove into the nearest buggy, which carried me down the corridor a little ways before finally emerging into the limbo-like loading room. All the effects were still running here, including the eerie music and sounds, but there was still no one else around. I yelled for help, but no one appeared. As soon as I could, I jumped out of the Doom Buggy and ran back up the line into the Hall of Morphing Portraits. Ahead was the door to the elevator, the stretching gallery, but I remembered that this area had a more immediate chicken exit, meant for those who were too scared to ride the ride and wanted to head back up to the park. The door was marked with an obvious exit sign, sitting between two shuttered windows that made it look like it led outside into a stormy night, and without hesitating, I pushed through that as well. Beyond was another corridor. On either side of me, flashing lights pointed at the windows to simulate lightning, flickering with each thunderclap that boomed through the hall, disorienting me even further. Turning left, I followed the hall as the floor inclined gently up, my throat tight and a stitch in my side. And then my throat closed altogether as I turned a corner and almost ran into the hatbox ghost. It was standing smack dab in the middle of the hall between me and the door that led outside. I scrambled backward instinctively, but the figure didn't move. It was a static prop, grinning its cadaver grin, backlit by a ceiling light further down the hall. The light also broke the illusion of the hatbox, and I could see vaguely the shape of the disembodied head through the scrim. I was convinced, thoroughly convinced at that moment, that thing was going to suddenly jerk to life and come after me. But it didn't. I had no idea how it had gotten there, from down in the sub-level, or how it had done so quickly. Maybe the one I'd seen below wasn't the only figure. Maybe Mike and Karen were pulling a fast one on me and had dragged the figure up with them. I was frozen, trying to figure out where to go next, not wanting to go anywhere near the ghosts, but not wanting to backtrack either, because I still felt like there was something sinister behind me. Nervously, I croaked out the names of my lost friends, but there was no reply. Noises from the ride seemed to come floating down the hall, muted but ever present. And then I heard the groan. It could have been a human groan or something mechanical, but I definitely heard it. It didn't sound like any of the standard audio, and it came from a point somewhere near or past the hatbox ghost, maybe even from further down the corridor past the exit. As if this were a trigger, I realized that either my eyes had adjusted to the dark, or the lightning had somehow changed, because I looked again at the hatbox, and I saw the thing inside through the scrim. There was still a head in there, but I know it wasn't the ghost's head. It wasn't even a cartoon caricature of a head. It wasn't Mike or Karen. As at this point, the details elude me. I know that what I saw shook me to the very core, and that's part of the reason it's taken me so long to recount this. I remember seeing that thing in the box, seeing that it was indeed a human head, a man's face, a face I didn't recognize, seemingly looking back out at me with a shocked, bleeding eyes. But after that, there's a blur of sheer terror and snatches of frightening images, gnarled hands, tombstones, pneumatic hissing, the stretching room going in reverse, shrinking too fast, the ceiling crushing toward me, the corpse hanging on the rafters descending on me. I try not to dwell on them too much, because now I'm no longer sure which really happened and which were the results of nightmares I'd have years later. The next thing I can remember clearly after that is being on my hands and knees just outside the fence of the haunted mansion, vomiting onto the pavement while around me crowds of people stood. Most of them weren't paying any mind to me. There were lots of whispered talk, and a few were even crying. There were red and blue lights, police cars parked nearby, but I couldn't tell why. I just sat there, gulping and sobbing, until a cast member finally noticed me and led me to a first aid station. Karen was there when I arrived, and she jumped up and hugged me tight when she saw me. I don't think either of us made much sense. We were both at our wits' end, but it was such a relief to see her after all that. And any questions I had fell by the wayside. I'll never forget how haunted she looked, wide-eyed, pale, barely able to form a sentence without tearing up. Mike never turned up. That fateful night has never left me, and in the years since, I've slowly begun to piece together the details, trying to vainly make sense of what happened. It's become sort of a private obsession, something I do in the background as I moved on with my life. First, it didn't take long for Karen and I to learn why the police cars were there, and they weren't there for us. According to the reports we heard later, an 18-year-old guy from New Mexico died while we were in the haunted mansion. He and a friend snuck into a backstage area on Tom Sawyer's Island and stole a rubber emergency boat to go for a joyride around the rivers of America. Apparently this guy was pretty drunk, and it wasn't long before he hit a rock, throwing he and his friend from the boat. His friend went for help, but he drowned before they could find him. His body was discovered an hour later. I wonder now if that's why there was no one around when we crept backstage. I managed to track down a few cast members who were working that night, and though most of them claimed that they were told by management to not cause alarm and keep to their posts, several admitted that they'd gone to check out the grim spectacle, especially those CMs that were on attractions near the river, like the Haunted Mansion. Was the timing such that everyone turned a blind eye while we stumbled into something hideous? Mike's disappearance was something me and Karen both felt deeply, and we tried for years to get something from anyone about it. His parents never heard from him, and a missing persons report was filed eventually. But we didn't tell the truth. I mean, who would believe us? We at least tried to steer the investigation toward the Haunted Mansion, saying that's where we last saw him, but it never went that far. Disney never got implicated in the incident, of course, though the park was his last known whereabouts. Karen and I eventually drifted, probably because we blamed each other for what happened. She never expressed to me what she'd experienced after we got separated. Either because she wanted me to feel guilty for leaving them behind, or that she, like me, can only recall so much. We were both too shaken to recount to each other, but time and distance make things easier, and with the advent of the internet, there was suddenly a wealth of new information. I've since begun to piece together clues. Almost immediately, I found our hatbox ghost. Plugging that into any search engine will turn up multitudes of pictures of that bow-legged, grinning figure that has often floated through my mind's eye in the dark. It was apparently part of the attraction when it first opened in 1969, and much of the promotional material of the ride at the time featured this character in his ubiquitous hatbox. He originally stood in the attic scene right across from the ghostly bride with a beating heart, but he was quietly removed from the ride after only a week. Apparently, the effect of his disappearing head never worked properly, so that's how the official account goes. In recent years, the Hatbox Ghost has gained a fan base, groups of Haunted Mansion fans that want to see him restored to the ride. It's wishful thinking, I'm sure, because that figure had to have been stored downstairs for a reason. It took longer to find out about the backstage area where the Doom Buggies go, that empty corridor not originally meant to be seen by guests. Disabled guests, however, travel that route all the time. Wheelchair access to the ride is done through the limbo-like loading room, and guests travel back around this room to reclaim their wheelchairs and head back out. I posted about it and posed queries for details about that area, but no one has ever given me a description that sounds anything like what I went through. It's been described as short, bland, but some sort of catwalk going over the track, but no mysterious alcove or obvious doorway. It takes less than 30 seconds for the Doom Buggies to go through, and then you're back in the loading room. I suspect Disney might have changed that area since the 80s, but why? Most recently, though, I've come across an odd factoid that seems more like a morbid curiosity than anything else, unless one's been through what I have. It's not about the Haunted Mansion, however, but its nearby e-ticket neighbor, Pirates of the Caribbean. According to the story, and this has been published in various Disney-owned books, so it's no vague rumor, the Imagineers who built the ride felt that the faux skeletons of the time weren't convincing enough for the underground grotto scenes. So they borrowed real human remains from the UCLA Medical Center, dressed them up as pirates, and put them in the caves. Let that sink in for a moment. Millions of people went by on boats and had no idea they were looking at real skeletons, all propped up in pirate gar. Eventually, a later team of Imagineers would replace these with more convincing facsimiles, and supposedly the bones were returned to their countries of origin and given a proper burial. But who's to say they were? What if something was left behind in that basement when the bones were taken, and what if the pirates weren't the only ride that did this? The show building of the Haunted Mansion was built along the rest of the New Orleans Square in 1963, but it took another 6 years for the actual attraction to open. Why the delay? It could have just been the gridlock from the 1964 World's Fair and Walt Disney's death in 66, could it? All this speculation, a string of understanding that raises more questions for me than it does answers. We want to get to the truth of what happened that night, but everything I've found doesn't add up to a concrete explanation. Perhaps there isn't one, though I desperately want there to be. And I can't go back. I won't. Not after the things I saw and felt. I haven't set foot in Disneyland since that night. Maybe, though. Maybe it's time I tried. Karen, if you're out there and you're reading this, I'm sorry about everything. I'm trying to make it right. Trying to put some meaning to this. Contact me if you can. I need to know what happened to you and Mike. Maybe you have the key to the mystery in your memories. I can't do it alone, but together, we might get to the bottom of this. For everyone else, let this stand as a testament. Some things are backstage for a reason, and the company like Disney must have a multitude of skeletons in the closet. Think twice before you pull some stupid stunt like I did, because it might not be the security that finds you.
We don't celebrate Halloween where I come from. My main exposure to it as a kid was through Western media, and while I didn't fully understand the premise, I found the general aesthetic of the holiday pretty neat and wished to experience it someday. Fast forward about 15 years, and I did end up moving to the U.S., albeit for more practical reasons. As a 20-something woman, it was safe to say I'd blown my chance at trick-or-treating, but that didn't mean I couldn't get into the Halloween spirit in other ways. It just so happened that one of my coworkers was throwing a spooky-themed party at his house as a sort of impromptu team-building event. I admittedly had a thing for said coworkers, so I was going regardless of the premise, but the fact that it was Halloween did boost my excitement even more. As soon as I stepped through that door, I immediately realized how underdressed I was for the occasion. I didn't expect people to go all out for a work event, but there was Bill from HR walking around in a full mummy getup, and Heather, our supervisor, strutting her stuff as a sexy witch. Meanwhile, there I was, dressed in an ordinary shirt and slacks with my dumb little devil horns on, standing in the middle of it all like a complete jackass. I rarely experience social awkwardness, but this was definitely one of those moments, especially since I was the new girl still trying to make an impression. Thankfully, the coworker I was interested in was too busy running back and forth from the kitchen to pay me attention. I figured my best course of action was to just blend with the background and dip after an hour or two. And then I saw him. I'm not exaggerating when I say that he was the most gorgeous man I'd ever seen. He wasn't in costume either, but I don't think it mattered in his case. He could have turned up in a full tracksuit and flip-flops and people would still want to be around him. He was tall, but not so tall that I felt intimidated walking up to him. His hair was brown with a reddish mahogany tone and fell in long curls that accentuated his cheekbones. He had a short ginger beard that, when combined with his plaid shirt, made him look like he was about to whip out an acoustic guitar at any moment. If you told teenage me to design her ideal boyfriend, it'd quite literally just be him. "Didn't get the memo either?" I asked with the most easygoing smile I could fake. I'd never approached anyone first before, but with him it felt so natural, like it was the obvious thing to do. He lifted his green eyes from the glowing screen of his phone and over to me. My chest fluttered when he smiled. It wasn't love at first sight, that'd be understating it. It was something more baseline, primal, but just calling it lust wouldn't have done it justice either. Imagine you've spent your entire existence confined to the ground, but then one day, the universe decides to give you the ability to fly. You never had the desire to fly before. But now that you've experienced what it's like to soar through the clouds, you can't picture a life without it. "You think I normally dress like this?" he jokingly replied. We hit it off straight away. Never had a man, especially one I just met, made me feel so at ease in his company before. Even though I just learned his name, it felt like we were old classmates having a long overdue reunion. Oscar. It suited him. Everything he did, everything he said, it just radiated this indescribable aura. It was captivating and, worse, hopelessly addictive. Every single time he acknowledged me, laughed at my jokes, or gave me a knowing wink, it made me want him all that much more. And it was as if he knew. No, there were no ifs or buts about it. He definitely knew. He knew, and he was using it against me, torturing me, see how far he could push me before I break. And break I did. It was I who practically pinned him to the wall and locked our tongues together, his stubble against my chin, his dexterous hands down my back. Euphoria in its most distilled form. As I began unbuttoning his shirt, he abruptly grabbed my wrist with one hand and the other he placed between us. I protested with a series of exasperated whines, unable to even put my frustration into words. Thankfully, his salacious smirk assured me that this awful craving wouldn't go unsated for much longer. "Not here," he said. "My place is just down the road." I breathlessly agreed. I tried to sound playful, but my desperation was obvious. This was no longer a want, it was a need that was burning me from the inside out. I needed to feel him, to taste him. I felt like my heart was going to give out if I didn't. To my relief, the walk to his flat was indeed brisk. I had to physically hold myself back from jumping his bones while we were alone in the elevator. The first thing I noticed when we entered his apartment was all the boxes scattered about the place. Either he was in the process of moving or preparing to do so, but I figured we could save that conversation for our pillow talk later. Talking about his living room arrangement was the last thing on my mind at the time. As soon as we crossed the threshold of his bedroom, our dynamic instantly shifted. It seemed as though Oscar had left his reserved facade at the door. He pushed me onto the bed and positioned himself above me, his breath melting my skin, but his lips were quick to cool it. His fingertips were like branding irons as he worked his way down to my thighs, marking every inch of me as his own. My mind went blank. Pain and pleasure mixed together in a forbidden cocktail from which I greedily drank every last drop. Livestock. That's all I was. That's all I was ever meant to be. A part of me subconsciously knew that I was going to die that evening, but I didn't care. What was the point of living if I'd never experienced such ecstasy again? Suddenly his doorbell rang, scattering the haze, clouding my thoughts for a short moment. I looked down and saw the mop of unruly reddish locks pull back from between my legs. He groaned loudly in annoyance. It's probably the old bag from downstairs, complaining about the noise again. Stay put, I'll deal with it. He threw a bathrobe on and exited the room, gently closing the door behind himself, almost as if he was trying to hide me. I flopped back against the now thoroughly soaked mattress. My vision spun, my entire body still ached with desire. Through the wall, I could hear Oscar and a sterner, gravelly voice exchanging words. How long was this going to take? Against Oscar's request, I slid out of bed and staggered toward the laminate door that appeared to lead to a bathroom. It felt like I was being boiled alive in my own sweat. I needed to find a way to cool off, at least until he came back to finish what he started. On my way there, however, something else caught my attention. I couldn't help but notice that the door to the closet was sticking out in a pretty odd way. Kind of like it was being pushed from the inside by something heavy. Must be a typical guy thing of piling all their junk in one place. My brothers were guilty of the same. Still, I didn't have anything better to occupy me, and Oscar was taking his sweet time chatting up his upset neighbor. Any distraction from the throbbing heat coursing through my lower half was a welcomed one. I approached the bulging door, picking up my bra on the way there and tossing it back onto the bed. The door was one of those fancy slidey ones. As my warm palm met the cool handle, I began to register a strange noise emanating from the other side. It was slow, rhythmic, almost whispery in a way. I pressed my ear to the wooden surface, closed my eyes, and listened. It sounded like breathing. There was no way. Surely not, but what else could it have been? A hissing pipe, maybe? Do pipes run through closets? I steadied my own breathing, grabbed the handle more firmly, and decided to just rip the proverbial band-aid off. If I was wrong, the worst that could have happened was that I would have totally ruined the mood and then had to help Oscar clean up. Unfortunately, I wasn't. Two whole goddamn bodies came tumbling forth from the closet. One belonged to a man and the other to a woman, at least as far as I could tell. They were so shriveled that it was genuinely difficult to deduce, reduced to little more than skeletons wrapped in a sheet of skin. It was as if all traces of moisture had been completely drained from them. The man was lifeless. I watched in horror as blood pooled beneath his skull and over the vinyl flooring. I would have assumed the woman dead too at first, but she began to stir. She tried and tried to get to her knees, but kept sliding on the other's fluids. I wanted to help, I really did, yet I was so utterly terrified I couldn't move a muscle. Finally, she succumbed to her frailty and collapsed back onto the floor, where she continued flailing her useless limbs in a pitiful display of helplessness. What the fuck did he do to them? Was he about to do the same thing to me? The thought caused my throat to contract. Shock became panic, and that's when the rush of adrenaline kicked in. My body was telling me in no uncertain terms to get the fuck out of that hellhole of an apartment. I crouched down beside the two bodies, frantically rummaging through the pile of discarded clothes. My phone had to be in there somewhere. A modicum of relief washed over me when I finally found the pocket where it was hiding and managed to fish it out. Before I could stand back up, the shriveled woman suddenly lunged at me, grabbing me by the ankle. My first instinct was to pull away, but her grip held surprisingly strong despite the horrible pop that came from her shoulder. Her face was difficult to look at. It was so gaunt that I could actually see the shape of her teeth through her cheeks. Her mouth was too dry to speak, so instead she placed the finger of her other hand to what remained of her lips. Then she pointed toward the bottom drawer of the nightstand. I could tell she wanted me to open it. With tears welling up in my eyes from fear, I gave a nod and did exactly that. Tucked behind pill bottles and a bundle of cables was a gun. I clutched it against my bare chest, feeling its weight, then checked the magazine. I had all its rounds. I pushed it back in with shaking hands, pulled the slide, and finally released the safety. One of the first things I did when I came to the U.S. was visit my local shooting range. It was just for fun. I never in a million years thought I'd actually have to put what I'd learned there into practice. Pistol in one hand and my phone in the other, I was finally allowed to rise to my feet. Standing on the opposite side of the bed that separated us was the sick son of a bitch himself. He didn't say anything, didn't reprimand me. His expression was one of mild annoyance, as if I were some cockroach that had crawled out of the drain. "Look, I just called the cops," I bluffed, waving my phone around while concealing the loaded firearm behind my back. I figured there was no point in escalating tensions any more than they already were. "If I were you, I'd leave now before they come." No reaction, not even a mocking smirk. He just stood there like a mannequin, his face half illuminated by the arrangement of LED lights on the wall. "Okay, I get it. You probably want to clean this mess up first. I'll just go and leave you to it then, yeah?" Carefully, with the gun still pressed to my lower back, I circled around the bed while maintaining eye contact. As I got about halfway over to his side, his entire head suddenly began to spasm. His body stayed perfectly still, but his head kept jerking back and forth as if he was trying to snap his own neck. I screamed as what looked to be two ivory horns burst forth from his eye sockets. The gleaming bony projections extended forward and then collided against his skull, scraping against the side of it before looping back around, this time with shreds of his own hair and flesh hanging from their pointed tips. I shut my eyes and blindly ran past the horrifying scene, stumbling out into the living room and making a beeline for the front door. Of course, it was locked. Vision clouded by tears, I started throwing my whole body against it in complete and utter panic. I shrieked for help at the top of my lungs. If the neighbors had a problem with my moaning before, there was no way they couldn't hear it now. There was a wet chuckle from the living room behind me. I snapped back around, gun pointed straight. That thing, that monster, was standing between the couch and the TV, fully in the nude. There was an oozing slit stretching from its navel base to its pubic area. It giggled as it held it open. From it slipped out what I can only describe as a long, pulsating tendril, at the disgusting end of which was something resembling a giant hypodermic needle. So that's what he did to them. I took a deep breath, gritted my teeth, grabbed the gun with both hands, and opened fire. The first bullet hit the couch. The second grazed the edges of the wall, but the rest found their mark, landing straight in its chest and causing it to stagger. I fired again and again, the recoil of each shot rattling every bone in my arms. I'm not sure how many rounds I let fly before I finally stopped to inspect the damage. That monstrosity or demon or whatever the hell it was gone. No body, no traces of blood. Just gone. And how? I had my sights set on it the entire time. I slowly made my way to the center of the living room. Silence. Nothing but the ringing in my ears. And then there was only pain. A crippling, all-consuming pain radiating upward from my left thigh and consecrating around my stomach as if my insides were being compressed between two blazing hot irons. My eyes dropped to the side of the creature's oversized stinger embedded within the side of my leg, wriggling as it burrowed itself even deeper. I couldn't even muster the coordinated effort to scream. The agony was indescribable. I sank to one knee and then both before ultimately collapsing onto my side. Despite my best efforts, I struggled to even get a hold of the slippery appendage to which the barbed needle was attached. All the while, a web of dark veins extended from the point of insertion and spread across my leg like black worms crawling beneath my skin. Emerging from the shadows unscathed, the monster grabbed a fistful of my hair and forcefully tilted my head up to face it. All I saw were teeth, rows upon rows of teeth, filed to a point and glistening with thick saliva. The fuck kind of nightmare was this? It couldn't be real. I refused to believe that it was real. I'd wake up any second now in my own room, covered in sweat, vowing to never read Wattpad stories before bed again. I clenched my jaw and pressed the barrel of the gun beneath the monster's drooling chin. I then shut my eyes tight and pulled the trigger. Things get a bit fuzzy after that. I remember the echo of the gunshot as it resonated inside my skull. I remember my ears popping and the world falling temporarily mute. I remember finally dislodging the creature's proboscis, or whatever the hell it was, from my leg as it recoiled back, clutching its mouth and then dragging my useless limb behind me. I remember its foot on my back and a piercing sting near my right shoulder blade. I remember desperately reaching out toward the front door's handle, only for the whole thing to come flying in, hinges and all. I remember two police officers standing there, firearms raised and looking horrified as they shouted to indecipherable demands to the abomination pinning me down against the carpet. I remember the feeling of weightlessness as it held me up by the back of the neck, using me as a hostage while it retreated backwards, only to then dump me back onto the ground and bolt for the nearest window. I remember the shattering of glass, closely followed by more gunshots, and finally I remember the blackness as it encroached upon the edges of my vision, then promptly swallowed me whole. When I was taken into custody, I expected them to stuff me in some lab or loony bin, depending on whether they believed my full testimony or not. Turns out, however, that my experience was far from unique. Incubi, they call them. Shapeshifters that take on the guise of humans in order to lure us in like the sinful little cattle we are and drain us down to the last drop. No one knows where they come from, or if they do, they aren't telling us. The frequency of reported incidents has escalated to the point where survivors are no longer segregated from society. I was just told to sign a non-disclosure agreement and sent on my merry way as soon as I could walk again. Surprisingly, besides a little numbness in my leg, I didn't seem to have any lasting damage, not physical, at least. I know I shouldn't be openly discussing this, but I don't think it matters at this point. I bet that by the end of 2025, if not sooner, the whole thing will be out in the open anyway. Until then, whether you believe me or not, you should be careful who you go home with. It was a quiet Sunday afternoon when the sobbing echoed through the apartment complex. Everyone rushed outside to find Jacob, kneeling in front of the leafless birch tree, crying. They stared in awe, unsure of what to do. After all, no one knew anything about him. The tenants stood shocked and confused as Jacob's fingers dug into the soil at the base of the tree, scooping handfuls of dirt into his pockets. He continued until his pockets were full, and then the crying ceased, just like that. The silence was so unnerving that some backed into their doorways as if taking a precautionary measure for an impending calamity. Dirt spilled from Jacob's pockets with each step as he slowly made his way back to his apartment. His movements were meticulous and deliberate. He seemed to savor each step like a mouthful of delicious food. Step after step, his neighbors watched with anticipation. Not sure what to expect, but sure that something would happen. But nothing did. This would be the last time anyone saw Jacob. Jacob was a strange old man. He'd leave his apartment once a day for exactly an hour and stand in the courtyard talking to the ground near that birch tree. No one really paid him much attention due to his age. An old man enjoying a quiet moment outside was really no cause for concern. He never spoke to anyone directly, and the conversations he had with the dirt were an incoherent string of babble. Everyone just kind of assumed he was senile, or suffering from any number of age-related mental disorders. His eyes were squinted, and from a distance it looked like as if he had no eyes at all, just black behind the lids. That, of course, gave the kids plenty of reason to avoid him. They would try to scare each other and tell stories of how he was really a ghost and how they had seen him perform numerous supernatural feats, even though none of them really had. The kids often played doorbell ditch, and Jacob's door was a favorite target, even though he never answered. Nothing was known about Jacob, but rumors and gossip surrounded his origins. The strangest part about him was he only left for that hour. He would never leave the apartment grounds, not for food or personal items. His rent showed up in the Dropbox on time, and other than being mysterious, he was honestly no trouble to anyone. No one had ever held a conversation with him in all the years that he'd lived there. Many residents tried, but he would just respond with, "Don't get dirty," and a closed-mouth smile. After a while, everyone collectively assumed that he would be okay and just wanted to be left alone. The days turned into a week, and no one had seen Jacob. Residents began to assume the worst. He was old, after all, and him dying wouldn't be a big surprise, but what happened that Sunday still resonated throughout all minds in attendance. After a week, William and Carter, the landlord and janitor, decided to check in on the old man. They approached Jacob's door cautiously, as if he had been previously threatening. They didn't know why they were nervous. They had no reason to be. They tried, but couldn't shake the feeling that something was not right. They stood in front of his door, hesitant, both unsure of what to do next. Carter banged heavily on the door 3 times. And they waited, but nothing happened. Carter banged again, and William yelled out,
"Hey, Jacob, you all right?"
Silence filled the air. Carter cocked his head to the side, listening for any noise inside. "Anything?" William asked. Carter shook his head. William removed a ring of keys from his pocket and inserted one into Jacob's door. He took a deep breath and pushed the door open, but to his surprise, it didn't budge. He pushed again, leaning his shoulder against the door. The door slowly slid open as William grunted and strained. He continued to push until it was open enough to enter. It was dark inside the apartment. Not just the absence of light, but dark like the inside of a closed casket. The darkness was thick, and for a moment, William thought about closing the door and calling the police. Carter placed his hand on William's shoulder. "Are you just gonna stand here and stare?" he asked. William reluctantly squeezed through the cracked door into Jacob's apartment. The room didn't seem as dark once inside, and the light from the cracked door offered a small amount of visibility, but not much. But the smell was unbearable. William covered his face with a shirt to try and block the smell. It was indescribably moldy, sour blend of fermented filth. Carter gagged, but fought the urge to throw up. Behind the front door, the refrigerator lay on its side, serving as a barricade. Carter wondered why Jacob would lock himself inside like that, and how such a frail man could have moved the refrigerator alone. He pushed the thought to the side for the moment. Carter managed to drag the refrigerator away enough to fully open the door. The outside light illuminated the living room and revealed a thick layer of dust and dirt covering the entire room. William couldn't believe it. The room looked like it hadn't been lived in for 100 years. Paint peeled from the walls while the furniture was rotted and dilapidated. William called out to Jacob, but got no response. They stepped further into the apartment. Each step caused a small cloud of dust to stir up into the air. They checked the entire apartment, but found no one inside. Jacob had either left in the early hours of the morning or just disappeared into thin air. As they checked each room, they found the windows covered by cardboard and nailed shut. The same thick layer of filth covered every room and everything in them. Everything about Jacob was a mystery, and growing in strangeness by the second. In all four corners of every room sat a small glass jar. Each jar had a melted candle sitting atop it. The candle remains dripped down the sides, partially obscuring the contents of each jar. Upon further inspection, the contents appeared to be dirt. The bathroom had the aforementioned jars in each corner as well, except in one of the corners sat a shrine. Glass jars formed a semicircle around several black and white photographs perched on a small wooden box. The largest one was a picture of a woman with the face scratched out. The other pictures were of strange cryptids and horribly deformed people. At least they looked like people. Some of the jars had liquid in them. Others had pieces of paper, buttons, feathers, insects, and dirt. Some jars were cloudy, and the contents were beyond recognition. Candles melted down to the base rested on top of each of them. Golden pendants with foreign shapes and symmetry draped over the shrine. Carter picked up one of the jars and held it close to his face. "What the hell is this?" he asked rhetorically. Something inside of the cloudy jar scurried, and he dropped the jar and stepped away, nervously wiping his hand on his pants. William leaned in and retrieved a handwritten note from under a broken jar. Loose soil spilled from the jar like the entrails of a bloated dead possum. He brushed the remaining dirt from the page with his hand. The note read, "From the dirt we came, and to the dirt we shall return. The earth hungers for what is rightfully his and grows impatient. The candle seals the jar, and the jar keeps them confined, keeps them trapped. If the prison is broken, avoid contact with the dirt at all cost. If it tastes your flesh, its thirst will not be quenched until it enslaves and consumes you. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, one by one they will come for us. Don't get dirty." They stared at the broken jar for a long moment. William looked down at his open palm, his hands covered with dirt crumbs and dark smudges. He immediately rubbed his hand on the side of his pants. They knew what the letter was implying, but refused to accept it as anything more than the rambling delusions of an old man who'd lost his mind. As they thought it over, the whole situation seemed more and more impossible, but some subconscious cue caused them to repeatedly wipe the dirt off their hands. Even if this had all been just some old man's final slip from sanity, it still didn't explain where Jacob had gone. All the windows were nailed shut from the inside. The front door was locked and pinned, closed by the refrigerator. Unless Jacob was a ghost and could really walk through walls like the neighborhood kids suggested, there was no other explanation. William laughed to himself at the thought. They pushed the supernatural thoughts out of their heads and went back to work, cleaning the place up as quickly as they could. Carter loaded all the shrine's contents, along with the jars in each room, into a box and tossed the box into a dumpster outside. The jars shattered as they hit the bottom of the dumpster. Carter stopped for a moment and thought of the letter. The letter bothered him, but he wasn't ready to succumb to Jacob's fantasy world that easily. A sunset approached. They retired to their own apartments. They didn't speak of the strangeness of that day. Exhausted and eager to push it out of their minds, they quietly parted ways. Carter sat slumped in a worn but comfortable recliner, drifting in and out of consciousness. The television illuminated the room as a popular talk show host recited a string of witty jokes to an enthusiastic audience. A procession of heavy-handed knocks came from the front door. Carter came to life, eyes wide and foggy, still half asleep.
Yeah, who is it?
Carter yelled from the comfort of his chair. No answer. He waited a long beat, and as he began to ask again, he was interrupted by more knocking. The heavy thuds reverberated through the house. The banging on the door at such a late hour was startling, but the dead silence that followed bordered terrifying. Carter grabbed a hammer from his toolbox and approached the door. He leaned in toward the peephole, squinting his right eye. As he inched closer, he could slowly begin to make out a silhouette, just before he could fully see any physical details. The visitor banged on the door again, this time shaking the door on its hinge. He jumped back, raising the hammer in his shaky hand. His heart pounded in his chest, breathing labored and body trembling. He stared at the door to his amazement and terror. The handle began to turn back and forth. It turned gently at first, but grew more violent with each turn. Carter stood paralyzed until the deadbolt lock slowly began to turn to the open position. He rushed to the door, pressing his shoulder against it and turning the lock back to closed. The door shook violently, as if someone were trying to knock it down. His body jerked with every impact. He slid up the door and gazed out through the peephole. His eyes widened with sheer panic as the view revealed what was on the other side of the door. The door continued to shake as Carter peered out into an empty hallway. There was no one there to take responsibility for the banging or attempted break-in. Just an empty hallway. This can't be, Carter thought. This isn't possible. His mind drifted back to the shrine in Jacob's house and the letter. He struggled to find answers, rational or supernatural. Just then the banging stopped flat. He waited for a moment, certain that this was a ploy for him to relax and let down his guard. He slowly stood to look out at the people again, not sure of what he was expecting to see. The phone rang loudly. He spun quickly with his hammer raised, only to realize it was nothing sinister. He snatched the phone off the hook, and screaming erupted from the receiver. It was William, hysterically yelling into the phone.
They're trying to get in. I can't see them, but they're breaking the windows and doors, and I can't keep them out. Oh, my God.
His voice grew more desperate.
Carter, listen to me. It was the jars, the letter, Jacob. I don't know what to do. I just don't let them inside. Oh, God.
The phone went dead. Carter held the phone to his ear in shock, shaking uncontrollably. The front doorknob began to shake and turn again. Carter rushed to the living room just as the door began to open. He crashed against it, slamming it shut and turning the lock closed. Across the room, a window began to slowly open. He grabbed it just in time, slamming it shut. The thought of Jacob's apartment came back. The refrigerator, the nailed windows, and the letter. He grabbed his couch and drug it across the living room. He flipped it over and pinned it to the door. The door handle continued to turn back and forth. Hammer in hand, Carter grabbed a handful of nails out of his toolbox and began to nail the window shut. The door banged violently against the couch, but he ignored it. His hands were shaking so badly that he dropped 4 nails for every one that he managed to hit with his hammer. He could barely hit a nail squarely on the head. He bent several nails, missed others completely, hitting the windowsill. From the other side of the window, an unsettlingly deformed face pressed against the glass. Carter screamed, dropping the hammer and falling to the ground. He couldn't reach the window in time. It slowly slid open. A thick gust of dust and sand blew in, blanketing the area near the window. Carter scrambled across the floor on his hands and knees. He coughed and gasped for air as the dust continued to pour in. Every grain of sand seemed to be alive as it moved to each corner of the room, covering everything. Carter crawled at the door, but the dust in the room made it hard to see or breathe. He tried to move the couch, but it was too heavy to move from his knees. He desperately clawed at the couch, moving it only a few inches. He gagged and struggled for air before finally collapsing. He was consumed right where he lay. His body was no more, just a mound of earth and sand. No one knew what happened to Carter and William. Some say they found a fortune inside Jacob's apartment and ran off with it. Others say they were taken by Jacob's ghost, but since no crime could be verified, the police were forced to add it to the pile of missing persons cases. The case was revisited shortly after, when two police officers involved with the case disappeared mysteriously. When William and Carter weren't seen for several days, the police were called. The missing officers were the first to respond to the call, and both entered the dirt-covered apartments. The rooms were considered a potential health risk, and everyone following them wore protective masks and suits when they entered. Several days went by, and neither officer came to work or answered their phones. Their wives and children also went missing. It was possible that they packed up and left, but no clothes were gone, no personal items missing, cell phones and credit cards were unused. All that remained in their homes was dirt and sand, shrouding everything inside.